We are heading into perhaps the most consequential local election in recent memory. Forecasters are expecting big gains for Reform and the Lib Dems and a bad showing for Labour and the Tories. Could we be looking at the end of the two-party system? To make sense of what comes next, please do come along to our local elections shake-up event. Join the Spectators panel and special guests Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg and Zia Yusuf as they analyse the results on the 7th of May at the Emmanuel Centre in Westminster. For tickets, go to www.spectator.co.uk/local-elections-live.
Hello, welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal. I'm joined today by James Johnson of JL Partners and John McTurnan, former political secretary to Tony Blair. And it is Tony Blair that today is making a bit of a splash in Westminster. His institute, the TBI, has put out a new policy paper talking about the costs of net zero. And in his foreword, Sir Tony has written some comments which are quite critical, not directly of the government in terms of specific policies, but trying to sort of say that governments around the world need to consider the cost of these eco-policies when they're sort of weighing up the burdens on everyday voters. I mean, John, what's your take on all this? Because in government, some will be saying that this is unhelpful timing. This is a couple of days before the local elections. And we all know Ed Miliband's under a bit of fire, as we saw on the Commons yesterday.
Look, Labour are cooked in these elections already, as we're going to discuss later in the podcast. I think, actually, if you read, and it's interesting, so far I've talked to about a dozen people this morning about Tony Blair's introduction to his pamphlet. I think I'm the only one who's actually read it. And the things that I would draw out of from it are, one, Tony says people feel they're being made to pay costs for a transition that they didn't cause. I think that's an absolutely accurate diagnosis of politics, and it goes to the heart of some of the energy exploited by the right in politics. But that's actually an issue that the government have grappled, taken head on. Ed Miliband's signature policy is the creation of Great British Energy. What could be more wrapping the flag around the green transition than having Great British Energy? What could more address the issue that Tony raises, that people feel they get no benefit from it, than to say, no, we'll have this which will provide energy security, we'll have this which will produce profits that can come back to the UK population. People can have this Great British Energy, which actually is owned by them and therefore benefits the country. The nationalism inside it, the patriotism, is really transparently there, and it's been there for a long time. It's like, one of the interesting things I think about modern politics is that Farage is cosplaying many of the Labour Party's most successful positioning. The other thing I'd say is, what does Tony bang on about, or his institute, sorry, bang on about in his report? Nuclear, new nuclear, and carbon capture and storage. And in Scotland, Scottish Labour are making that the battleground with the SNP, the need for new nuclear. And so I think there is actually policy alignment and also rhetorical alignment.
I suppose the timing, inevitably, 48 hours for the locals, I know that they're going to get stuffed, as you put it, but given how much some of the Labour lot came out and sort of Ed Miliband's team were saying, you know, Kemi Badenoch, you know, net zero, her comments, I mean, these comments would seemingly echo the remarks she was making about 6-8 weeks ago when she said the net zero wasn't properly thought through.
Well, net zero obviously is a Tory policy. It was Theresa May course, that brought net zero, put it into a legislative framework. And Tony was one amongst a series of prime ministers in the UK who've signed up to getting to where we need to on net zero, because if we don't act, Lincolnshire will be flooded by 2050. You know, Lincolnshire, where British Steel is under threat by rising sea levels. There are things that have to be done. Tony's point, as a great politician, a great communicator, is, are we winning the argument for it? Running away from net zero doesn't deal with the issue, which is the problem that Kemi Badenoch has. What does she stand for? What's she for? If Labour were to resolve from net zero, the question would be asked, on the progressive end of politics, what is it Labour are for, apart from being reform light?
I don't want to bring James in here. I mean, I was chatting to a Labour figure earlier this week who said that what Reform have done in recent months is pivot not just from being anti-net zero to sort of arguing for full-on reindustrialisation. You know, critics will say that's sort of Farage trying to channel a better yesterday, talking in sort of tones about industries that simply won't come back in the post-globalised world. But I mean, James, it's sort of a shift which is interesting, isn't it? Because you've got this sort of socially conservative, slightly more economically left electorate, which doesn't seem to have anyone representing it right now.
Yeah, I think that's right. And look, Nigel Farage with that sort of messaging is more aping Donald Trump, I think, than Arthur Scargill, which is about sort of referencing bringing jobs back, bringing manufacturing back, the reindustrialization point that you mentioned there. Look, I think trade is less of a live issue in the UK than it is in the US. We don't have the same scale of deficits with other countries. It's not been sort of weaponized as an issue by any leading politician. So I think the reindustrialization stuff is a little bit less politically pertinent than it is in the US. But nonetheless, Nigel Farage's key base is older, working class men and women who are very frustrated with the economic direction of the UK. So, you know, as a political message, I suspect there's not much harm there. And I think John's right that, you know, the challenge for politicians with net zero is to show that you do still stand for something on it. And Labour clearly are still saying, you know, we are the party who are going to do this, whereas Reform are saying they're not, but they have got an answer. And actually, Kenny Badenoch does seem to have been stuck slightly in the middle on these two things. The thing, by the way, with the Blair comments that I was struck by, and I mean this as a compliment, is that Blair is the ultimate shapeshifter. You know, this is, yeah. he is the man who knows which way the wind is blowing, and it's why he is the most electorally successful politician of our era. You know, I remember in some of the books about the end of his time in office, you know, Gordon Brown hadn't have taken over, then Tony Blair was getting ready to cut public spending. You know, this is the person who moves with the times, and I suspect that he's probably a little ahead of the curve of where Labour will have to be in the coming months and years.
I mean, John, I mean, before we come on to the discussion about local elections, just to talk to us a bit about how the relationship between Tony Blair and Keir Starmer is, because as James says there, you know, he is the ultimate shapeshifter. He is someone for whom huge amounts of both the Labour Party, the Labour movement, and the wider commentariat have enormous respect and listen to and sort of see, try and read the tea leaves and where he is at. What's the relationship like between them?
It's a very warm, close, personal relationship. That was very obvious when at the annual TBI conference a couple of years ago, Tony interviewed Keir on stage, and it was clear from the way they talked to each other, not just they respect each other, there was a warmth, there was a humour that Keir understood Tony very well. And this was not the first conversation, it was one of many. And I think that's the situation. If you know, Tory prime ministers, when they become prime minister, normally have quite a few other Tory prime ministers who are around they can talk to. Labour prime ministers very rarely have a predecessor who they can talk to, because Labour governments come round so rarely. And I think Tony, the interesting thing about Tony is he does still feel connected to the political currents that are around. He's not like a politician who keeps going, in my day, let's do it like in my day. I thought his interventions on the pandemic were interesting, where he looked at the science, he looked at the impact, and he says split the doses. And that was a practical application, a policy solution. And I think his relentless search for progressive policy solutions that will work and that will stick is a huge energy. And his ability to communicate remains so compelling. So whatever he says, you have to listen. And there was a period when I used to get caught onto the radio and the TV when Tony had said something, and people said, it's very interesting what he's saying, but will anybody listen? And I said, well, I'm on the TV and the radio talking to you because Tony said it. And it's like he's kept that. He's come through, and he uses his influence powerfully, I think. And this debate does have to happen, because the energy behind the far right on Europe and an energy behind the Trump election is feelings. And so you have to deal with the feelings as well as with the science. I think that's really important. And if Labour listens to Tony, they're more likely to get re-elected at the next general election than if they spurn him. I do think you can't turn away from your most successful leader ever.
Now, this is the last podcast we're doing before the local elections. We've done a fair few talking about that, and I think that speaks to something perhaps of a bit of a gap in British politics. But James, I mean, what sort of changed over the course of this campaign? I mean, I spoke to the pollster Robert Hayward a few weeks ago, and he said that over the course of the campaign, it seems there's been a bit of a shift away from Labour towards Reform slightly. What are the sort of surprises we're expecting come Friday?
Yeah, I think not much has shifted. I think most people aren't paying attention. It's the sad answer, the boring answer for the politicos listening in. I think what has happened is that people have, those who are planning to vote, have seen them coming into view And I think they've basically realised that this is one epic, open, free shot to punish the government. And that this usually happens in local elections, but I think that is even more the case this time because they feel also let down by the Conservatives, who, you know, their time in government feels very, very recent. They always still feel like an incumbent, I think, to a lot of people. And of course, they now have a very clear alternative in Reform and Nigel Farage. So I think that's why we've seen that increase. I mean, there is no downside really to voting Reform unless you're very passionate about a local issue that they disagree with on a local level, in which case you'll do whatever makes sense for you. So look, I think Reform are going to do well. I think the question about how well they do is dependent slightly on turnout. People who are most likely to vote Reform are not necessarily always the people who are most likely to turn out in local elections. They actually look very different from the UKIP, the old UKIP support in 2015 as a result. Back then, the UKIP voters looked like ex-conservatives. They were sort of over 65, more affluent, more likely to turn out in local elections. The average Reform voter now is actually more likely to be between the age of 45 and 65 and be a bit more working class, be a bit more disengaged in politics. So there is a question there. Will they actually come out and vote in the numbers that they do? But regardless of that, I think we're talking there about a difference between a good performance and a very good performance. I suspect that Reform will be the story come Friday or Saturday morning.
And also looking at the timings as well, I mean, you've got the Runcorn by-election, you've got some of those metro mayors at 3 in the morning, 3, 4 in the morning, and then you've got sort of a long gap, sort of around 11, 12 hours before we actually get to any of the sort of other counties where it could be about Tory Lib Dem, for instance. I agree about the point about UKIP is really interesting because, of course, the high watermark in some ways for UKIP was 2013 when they won 23% of the vote, but they finished second loads of places. So interested to see how that shakes out. John, I think we can all agree Labour will have a difficult night. Assuming it sort of broadly in line with expectation, not spectacularly better or worse than what we think, how does Labour respond to these local elections? And how, if you were advising a minister going out in the airwaves on Friday morning, how should they interpret and spin these results?
Look, I think the first thing any minister should say, any Labour minister should say is, we got no honeymoon because this is difficult times to govern. We're making the right decisions, making hard decisions for the long term. I think you have to stick to that, and then you have to take it on the chin yourself, and then you have to say, the one thing we really need to look at is normally when the government of the day is unpopular, the opposition get the benefit of that. And look at what's happened to the Tories. They have been humiliated a second time. So worst defeat, one of the worst defeats in electoral history just last July. We're in trouble and they're not recovering. There's a crisis on the right and the Tory party, you know, they're moving to the question of not whether, but when they have to do a deal with Nigel Farage and Reform. What a humiliation there is for that. I think if I was advising government, I'd say the responses to electoral defeat, which are simple, obvious and wrong. And the top of that for me would be a panic reshuffle. And then there would be a desire, well, if people have voted for Reform, let's move towards them in policy areas. We should pause a second and look, what has Labour been successful in doing and saying? Successful when offering to nationalise British Steel. Successful and popular when it's raised the minimum wage to its highest levels ever, a proportion of average wages. Successful and popular with renters' rights. Successful and popular and effective with the OBR and with growth on planning reform, house building, development, infrastructure reform. Basically, the government has been successful when at its most interventionist in the market. One might say, you know, look, Great British Energy, I mentioned already, Great British Rail, the nationalisation of it, at its best when at its most soft left. So don't panic, go, okay, all of these things have been successful. What hasn't worked? Cutting the winter fuel allowance. It's time to reverse that policy. It comes up on the doorstep, it comes up in the focus groups. Why are Labour so cruel? It's not brand Labour, Labour needs change. So I think I wouldn't say the second half of that on doing the morning round or the afternoon round after the elections. It's going to be a rugged night for Labour. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But if the electors, the voters send you a message, get it and change.
Well, for any ministers listening, there's some free advice for you from John. Thanks, John. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening to Coffee Hour Shots.